summertime.
Ah, summertime. Can you believe that half the summer, more than half the summer, is already gone? God, that's depressing. Summertime blues indeed. Quite appropriate. It is Sunday, August 7th, 2011. This is episode 171 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here on SCScoops.com. I am the Solid Monster. Who else would I be? Glad that you can join us. Want to just give a quick mention here at the top of the show that we are perilously close to 1,000 Facebook friends. Probably by the time most of you listen to this, we will have broken the mark. So I want to just give an advanced shout out to all of you. Thank you all for making that page a lot of fun. The more people we get on there, the better it gets. Always good to have new faces on there, hear different voices and all that. So if you are not already a friend on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster, all one word. It's not the Solomonster, although the name on the Facebook page is the Solomonster. But that was only because at the time I was actually forced to put that as a name. For whatever reason, it wouldn't let me put the Solomonster, and it just kind of grew on me. So I've always kept it that way. But you can go to facebook.com/thesolomonster, even if you're not really big on Facebook. I know a lot of you actually hate Facebook with a passion. If ever there was a time to make an exception and join one page and friend one person in the Facebook world, I would be that person. Now would be that time. So yeah, get on there, and who knows? Whoever number 1,000 is, I'm tracking it. Maybe we'll do something special. I don't know, but you won't know unless you get on there. So check it out. A lot happened this week. Boy, this was a newsworthy week, and really it didn't get newsworthy until the end of the week. And unfortunately, it was one of those Black Fridays for WWE, which tends to happen every now and again. I guess, you know, people are calling these the belated post-WrestleMania cuts. You know, the cuts that come, what, 6 months after WrestleMania? They kind of delayed them, I guess. You know, there was a lot of talk a couple of months ago that there would be some releases, and nothing really ever happened, and the WWE released its quarterly earnings, its financial numbers this week, and wouldn't you know, the very next day, a bunch of people get cut. One person claims to have quit. We're going to run through the whole thing here right at the top of the show. First of all, Gail Kim was the first person to go on Twitter and claim that she had left WWE. Not that she had been fired or that she had been released. And in fact, of all the people that WWE made mention of being gone on their own website, as far as I know, I don't believe they ever put anything up about Gail Kim. But Gail Kim claims that she quit WWE this past Monday, which is pretty surprising considering that we went from Monday to Friday without hearing a word about Gail Kim being gone from the company. And in fact, there was a Divas Battle Royal on Raw last Monday night that Gail Kim was a part of, and she was either one of the first or the very first person to be eliminated from the Battle Royal. In fact, I think she basically eliminated herself, went on Twitter in the days since Raw and was answering questions from people and, you know, pretty much not being very complimentary of the company, claiming that, you know, they told her to be out of there in a minute and go home, so she just decided to take herself out of the Battle Royal. And no mention at all during the week that she quit the company on Monday. So that's a little bizarre. But nonetheless, she is apparently gone, has been very unhappy with her role in the company, and it's not, you know, a big surprise, because if you look at the way that she's been used, she's been completely underutilized. You know, she's probably one of the better female performers they've had on their roster. I go back to the first time she was in the company many years ago. You know, her first night in, she actually won. I believe she won a Battle Royal, ironically enough, on Raw to become the women's champion. I believe there may have been an injury. I think Jazz maybe was champion at the time, and she won the title her first night in. And went on to have, you know, a decent run in WWE. And then at some point, she got cut from the company. And I don't remember anybody coming up with a good reason as to why that happened. I never heard any stories about her being a problem backstage, having an issue with anybody. Certainly, she was blindsided by the move, did not want to be released by the company. That was a very suspect move when that took place. And of course, WWE's loss was TNA's gain. Gail Kim went to TNA, became one of the centerpieces, really, of their Knockouts division, back when the Knockouts meant a lot more than they do now and had a lot more athletic talent, quite frankly, than they do now. And Gail Kim and Awesome Kong went on to have, I guess, you know, to use an analogy, what would be tantamount to the version of, you know, Austin and Rock or Bret and Shawn, you know, some of the greatest rivalries in history. They had a tremendous feud that really put that Knockouts division on the map for the championship in TNA during those mid-years. So Gail Kim left TNA, if you'll recall, because they were unwilling to pay her what she felt she was worth. I mean, we've heard horror stories from some tons of wrestlers who have come out publicly, and even some stories that were kind of leaked from anonymous sources. But they all have one thing in common, one common theme, and that is that TNA, by and large, treats its talent, especially its female talent, like dog shit, at least in terms of what they pay them, and they ask them to go out there and put their necks on the line, and they don't get a whole lot in return. And, hey, nobody ever said life was fair, but the bottom line is Gail Kim was unhappy with what was offered to her by TNA. She made it very well known. She wanted to stay in TNA. She made a lot of friends there, had no real reason to leave other than the fact that she had to pay her bills and wanted to make a decent wage. That paved the way for her to come back to WWE. So right off the bat, you know that her coming back to WWE is not something that she really, really wanted. And so I wonder if her head was really in the game from the beginning. And then she was just thoroughly unhappy with how she was used, completely underutilized. I mean, she's a tremendous talent, and we all know how they treat the divas. You know, you go out there, you've got a minute to have a match, and that's it. You know, you don't get more than that because the divas just don't get that sort of attention. And even when the divas get a minute or two in the ring, it's people like Kelly Kelly and Maryse that always got the attention, the Bella Twins. It was never Gail Kim. It was hardly ever, you know, Beth Phoenix or Natalya. After their initial pushes, they were just kind of background performers. And this is the end result. You know, Kim said, that's it. I'm done. I quit. Whether or not she would go back to TNA, I don't know. You know, quite frankly, TNA's financial situation has not changed all that much. If anything, it's probably gotten worse in the time that Kim has been back in WWE. I don't know what they could possibly pay her that would make her happy, but keep in mind that if she wants to have a real career in wrestling and work on the big stage, by quitting WWE, if she's unwilling to go back to TNA because of the pay situation, I don't know what her other options are. You know, there's always Ring of Honor, who's getting TV shortly. She can work independent. Maybe she can go overseas. I don't know what her options are, but she seems to be in a happier place now, and so good for her. Speaking of divas no longer in the company, Melina was released by WWE, Melina Perez, and obviously there's been a lot of talk for a while now that Melina's days in WWE were numbered. She was not making people in the company apparently very happy with her comments on social media. She does these video blogs, which I've got nothing against. I mean, hell, I basically do an audio blog every week. But the difference is, I don't have Vince McMahon and Johnny Ace and people in the company who frown upon that sort of thing, listening to my every word. And she would, you know, a lot of times she would answer fan questions on her Twitter and such about, you know, I don't think WWE is using you correctly. And first of all, why even publicly address those things? You know, again, I look at it like this. From WWE's perspective, all these disgruntled employees, I'm not saying they don't have a reason to be disgruntled. If I were them, I'd probably be very frustrated as well. But the point is, when you work for an employer, when you have a boss, when you work for a large company, and you know how sensitive they are to these things, and you know you have the wrestling media, the wrestling websites, sites like SE Scoops and all of that out there that are going to hang on to your every word, and even the slightest misstep is going to be reprinted and blown up into a much bigger story. It's no different than the mainstream media, quite frankly. You need to be sensitive to these things. And she had to have known that people were not very happy with her. She's been in the doghouse off and on so many times. I can't remember the last match, quite frankly, on Raw that Melina won. It seemed like every match when she actually would appear on Raw at all would be some sort of tag match or maybe a singles match, or she would always lose. She would always take the losing fall. It didn't matter that she was in a relationship with John Morrison, who happens to be one of the bigger rising young stars in the company. You would think perhaps then that it would work to her advantage, and in fact it didn't work to her advantage at all. If anything, perhaps it worked to her disadvantage. And you know, you would hope that it won't have any sort of effect on Morrison. He already came out with comments saying that he supports Melina. You know, I don't think it's a situation like Jerry Lawler and the Cat, for example, many years ago when he was dating Stacy Carter, who got released from WWE, and in protest Lawler quit. And he was gone. He was basically gone for almost a year from the company. In fact, Lawler missed pretty much the entire Invasion storyline and one of the bigger WrestleManias of all time before ultimately he came back to the company at the end of 2001. So anyway, Melina already went and posted an audio blog of sorts, about 5 minutes, just to address her fans, thank her fans for their support, and all of that stuff. And, you know, she always came across to me as just being very whiny, you know, just very whiny, which I guess is what a lot of people disliked her for backstage. And, you know, I guess really what she's known for, she's essentially the female version of Gumby. You know, she's very flexible and bendable. And there was one spot in particular, I think it was a match a couple of months back on Raw she had with Natalya when Natalya was the Divas champion. And she put Melina in a sharpshooter. Now, a lot of us have seen some really bad sharpshooters since Bret Hart retired. I mean, really bad. Like, god-awful. Even The Rock. God bless The Rock. Every time that poor bastard would put a sharpshooter on somebody, it looked like he was in more pain than his opponent. And people would stand up instead of leaning back because they didn't want to hurt the other person. I don't know. I watched Bret Hart wrestle for well over a decade, and Bret prides himself on the fact that he never once, which may not be the truth, but he never once hurt another opponent in the ring. It was always, working with him was always like working with a pillow. It was like working very soft, very easily. And I saw Bret Hart put plenty of sharpshooters on people that looked pretty painful and apparently didn't cause much pain at all. But yet people are petrified, or maybe they were told, you know, don't lean back on the sharpshooter. But the point is, in this particular match, this may have been one of the best sharpshooters I've ever seen anybody apply. And because Melina is so flexible, I mean, Natalya practically had her bent in half. It was impressive. That's what I'll remember Melina for. As a worker, nothing special. You know, some people may disagree with that, but, you know, I never really saw anything overly special with her. You know, she can scream very loud. She's very flexible. She had an interesting entrance with the splits that she would do. But overall, she just rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and because of that, she's gone from WWE. Vladimir Kozlov is gone from WWE. He's been doing the comedy shtick with Santino now for quite some time, turned babyface and was kind of entertaining. Again, you know, that Tea Time with Santino segment that they did on Raw in the UK with Sheamus last year, I said before, is probably the most entertaining segment I can recall from Raw in all of 2010. It was genuinely funny, and Kozlov was a big part of that segment. So Kozlov had, like, good comedic timing, and he could be very entertaining in that role. As a wrestler, obviously, he was very limited in what he could do. He had improved somewhat, but he was still pretty bad. Not Kali bad. You know, but he has that Sambo, I think it's pronounced Sambo background. But, you know, he would do the headbutts. He can throw people around the ring. Very strong guy. I still remember when he first came to WWE, there was a big feature on the website when Jerry Jarrett, who I think by that point had already left the fold in TNA, because remember, it was Jerry and Jeff, father and son, the founding fathers of TNA Wrestling, and he and his son had a falling out. In fact, I don't even know what sort of relationship they have these days. I don't think it's a very good one, if there is one at all. But I know at the time when Jerry Jarrett popped up on WWE.com with this huge Russian, whose real name is Oleg Prudius, and he would go on to become Vladimir Kozlov, there were a lot of people in TNA who were absolutely enraged, including Jeff Jarrett, because they looked at that as an act of betrayal. You know, here's Jerry Jarrett, one of the founding fathers of TNA, and, you know, it's almost like he's this new talent scout. You know, he's found this tremendous talent, and here he is bringing him to WWE, and I still don't understand what the point of that was. I mean, perhaps Jerry Jarrett really did make a recommendation that, hey, you should check this guy out, and then they, you know, he came along with him. I don't know the whole story. It's not like Jerry Jarrett came in with him as a manager or anything like that. But that was my first memory of Vladimir Kozlov, and I just remember those early matches when they were really giving him the big push, and he actually had a pay-per-view match with Triple H. I believe it was a singles match. It could have been a triple threat, but the point is he was in the ring with Triple H on pay-per-view, and Triple H is a tremendous talent, but he ain't no Ric Flair, he ain't no Shawn Michaels. Not even the great Triple H could carry Kozlov at that point to a good match. And like I said, he's gotten a little bit better over time, but is it a big loss to WWE? Are that many people going to miss Vladimir Kozlov? Of course not. I'm sure he'll be just fine. The Masterpiece, Chris Masters, another casualty of WWE's Black Friday cuts. And he's an interesting case. You know, Masters, I see a lot of sympathy for Masters. A lot of people, you know, somewhat upset, not overly enraged or anything, because it's not as though they were doing a whole lot with the guy. But Masters is another interesting case. I mentioned Gail Kim being with the company, leaving and coming back. Masters was given the biggest push you can imagine, because he was a big guy. Vince McMahon has a hard-on for big guys. We've known this for years. Masters came in, it probably was, what, around 05, 2005, I think, and they gave him this big grand debut with the special entrance with the pyro, and he looked like Atlas. You know, he would get up, and he would pose and flex, and he was just this big, jacked-up dude. Really young guy, very green. The consensus was that he just was not ready for that push, especially that level of a push at that point. He had a feud briefly with Shawn Michaels, I believe, might have been the month after SummerSlam when Michaels had that match with Hogan. And they were supposed to have a cage match rematch the next month at the September pay-per-view. And obviously that never happened. Hogan left. And I think Michaels at that point transitioned into a brief feud with Masters. And, you know, the thing with Masters is, it was obvious at the time that he wasn't ready. It was obvious that he was being given a push because he was this big, jacked-up, freaky-looking dude. And he just wasn't very good. I think he got hurt is what may have happened. But the point is he left WWE and went overseas to ply his craft. He went over to Europe. He found solid work over there. And a funny thing happened. He went overseas to work basically, you know, some of the bigger independents, and he got better. And he got smaller, which is the other key. Perhaps that had a lot to do with it as well. You know, when you're carrying a lot of weight, you're a big muscled up guy, you're very limited in what you can do. He lost a lot of weight. Why that is? Well, I'll leave that up to your imagination. But, you know, he looked healthier, he looked a lot slimmer, and he got better as a wrestler. And he improved a lot, he learned a lot. Funny how that works when you go overseas to work elsewhere and actually get to wrestle a lot, and you just happen to get better. It's funny how that works. And he came back to WWE. I don't remember exactly when he was hired back. I'm pretty sure it was sometime last year. And since he came back, really the biggest thing they did with him, I think, was he would appear on those Raw segments and every now and then on one of those funny pay-per-view skits where he would make his pecs dance up and down. And everybody laughed. Ah, ha, ha, that's so funny. And it was entertaining. After the second time, it wasn't as entertaining. And after the third or fourth time, it really wasn't entertaining at all. But he was a much better wrestler. You know, he had a lot of good matches on Superstars. I saw one or two of them. I didn't see enough of him to really say, wow, Chris Masters is so much better than he used to be. Because I admit, how often I watch Superstars is, you can count the fingers on one hand probably the number of times I've watched Superstars over the last 6 months, and you'd still have fingers left over. But by all accounts, Masters had gotten better and probably deserved at least a shot on one of the big two shows, Raw or SmackDown, to get some sort of push. You know, he became a babyface. His hold, you know, the Master Lock was kind of over with the audience. And, it's a shame. It's a shame. The guy went away. He got better. He came back. And they really just didn't have anything for him. Creative had nothing for him. It's not the first time we've heard that before. The only question is, where does he go from here? You know, he posted on his Twitter, I believe, it was a shock to him to find out that he was cut, but he would persevere, he would, you know, battle through it and come back, and, you know, where he goes, I don't know. Again, would he go to TNA? Well, if he has hopes of coming back to WWE, I would advise against it, and I'm not even sure TNA would want him. I made a joke, actually, on Facebook and Twitter after all these WWE cuts on Friday that it was a sad day to be a WWE talent, or as TNA likes to call it, draft day. And I was only half joking when I made that comment, because not to insinuate that TNA is just going to make an offer to every single person that got cut by WWE, but a lot of times when things like this happen, they start salivating at the mouth, because, oh, these are WWE guys, and hell, if they were used on TV recently, we can put them on TNA, as though it's going to have any impact at all on their TV ratings, which I just find tremendously comical. They almost brought in Test once, you know, when he got let go by WWE, and even they decided against bringing him in. I just find it funny because they brought in Hulk Hogan, they brought in Ric Flair, Sting, not even Sting because he wasn't in WWE. Kurt Angle may be the best example of that. And Angle had an impact at the very beginning when he first came in, but after a certain period of time, much like Mick Foley and Booker T and all these other guys, they mean shit to TNA. So these lower-level guys that they bring in, if they have any expectations that it's going to have any sort of impact on their ratings, I find it funny. And to be fair, I have not heard that TNA has actually had any interest in making an offer to any of the release people yet, but there's still time to make that happen. And of all the people that got cut, I think the one that TNA may have an interest in, and if I were them, I might actually go ahead and make an offer to this person, it would be David Hart Smith, the son of the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith. This, to me, is one of the biggest mysteries of all. What happened to the push of David Hart Smith? Why did it seem as though, you know, he was part of the Hart Dynasty? They held the tag team titles at one point. That was around the time that Bret Hart was in, so perhaps they were just trying to use Bret Hart to get them over more. You know, a lot of people say a lot of different things about, oh, this guy is vanilla, he's boring. And I've heard certain people say that about David Hart Smith. I'm not saying he's the most charismatic guy in the world, but you know what? Neither Bulldog was more charismatic, but it's not like the British Bulldog himself was the most charismatic person. He got over on his talents. You know, he's a very talented performer. His son is also very talented. His son did things the right way in that David went around the world. You know, he competed all over the world. He competed in Japan. He competed in Mexico. I believe he may have competed in Europe. All before he ultimately came to WWE. And that was on the advice of people in the industry and older wrestlers who said, look, this is what you need to do. You need to get seasoned in these different places, in these different territories, and then come to WWE. You'll be a more well-rounded performer. And as an in-ring performer, I thought he was pretty good. Very talented guy. You know, he had the size that WWE liked. And he had that pedigree. You know, being a second-generation star, son of the British Bulldog, who was a big-time star in WWE. It always puzzled me, it still does, quite frankly, why he didn't at least get a chance at a big push. I know when they first brought him up, when he was D.H. Smith, he had that wellness policy failure. That was the famous incident where they kind of hid it for a while before they revealed that he actually had flunked a test. But it's not as though other people haven't failed tests. It really wasn't a big deal. I don't see why that would have been a black cloud over his head for the rest of his career. He had the size, he had the look, he had the talent, he had the pedigree. It is the biggest mystery to me of all these cuts. I can't say it's a big surprise. They have done nothing with him on television. At one point, they gave him this ridiculous gimmick. He was coming out in a cowboy hat. He's talked a lot, I think, about either possibly dabbling in MMA, going back to Japan to do wrestling over there. I think he'll be okay. I think he has other interests outside of wrestling that he could probably excel in. I wouldn't be worried about the guy. But to me, this may have been the biggest failure on WWE's part to capitalize on the potential that this guy had. You know, what they call a diamond in the rough. Of all these guys, David Hart Smith was that diamond in the rough. And not a surprise, but again, I think it was a big mistake on WWE's part. And speaking of mistakes, speaking of cuts and releases and people quitting, got to talk about TNA really quick here. Big talent in TNA quit the company this past week. And when I say big talent, I don't mean big in that he was one of the bigger stars in the company, but very big on talent for a small guy. I'm talking about Amazing Red. Basically left the company this week, citing issues that I believe it had to do with pay. Wasn't getting paid enough. Big shock, by the way, hearing that from a TNA performer. The guy he just oozes talent. And I think, again, speaking of mistakes, here's a mistake where the company is not showing the proper level of appreciation for the talent that truly deserve it. There's plenty of guys who have much bigger names and probably are physically much, much larger than Amazing Red on the TNA roster right now, who are making a lot more money but don't deserve it. Now, that's been the story, I'm sure, of not just the wrestling business. You could say that about almost any industry. Stuff like that happens. But just to give you an example, you know, I went to the TNA baseball show at the baseball stadium in Brooklyn, New York last month. And I went to the one a year ago. And both times I brought a friend of mine who is a what I would call a lapsed wrestling fan. He was a big wrestling fan when he was younger, and he and I were, you know, we were big into the Monday Night Wars, and we would talk about it all the time. And I think he was a fan going back to the early 90s. So he was a fan of wrestling for years. And then as he got older, kind of fell out of it. Wrestling got boring. He grew up, had other interests. It happens to a lot of people. And he'll still keep tabs on it, mostly through me, as far as what's going on. And he'll check out bits and pieces of Raw every now and then. But he was excited to go to that first TNA show a year ago at the baseball stadium. So I took him with me. And when the show was over, the one thing that he really remembered that blew him away was the opening match. Because the opening match of the show in July of last year, if I remember correctly, was, I think it was a four-way match. I remember Homicide being in it, and Amazing Red was in it. And billed as a native from Brooklyn, New York, so he got the big hometown pop. And Red was awesome in that match. I don't remember if he won. He might have won. But it's irrelevant. But he put on a performance that night that this guy, who isn't even much of a wrestling fan anymore, was still raving about when the show was over, and that was in the opening match. Fast forward to the most recent TNA show at the baseball stadium last month. He came with me again. Amazing Red, ironically, is in the opening contest. And again, Red blew everybody else away. My friend could not stop raving about this guy. In fact, before we even sat down to get our seats, he was saying, hey, is that little guy from Brooklyn, is he going to be back on the show this year? And sure enough, when he came out, my friend popped huge. He was really over with the crowd. Now, again, it was Brooklyn, but still. The guy has a lot of talent that even people who aren't diehard wrestling fans can recognize. He's just a very exciting performer to watch. He can do things in the ring that very few people can. There's very few people who can do that. Rey Mysterio is one of them. And I would put Amazing Red in a similar category. And yet here's TNA unwilling to make him an offer. I hardly think the guy was asking for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and yet TNA cannot find it within their budget. They cannot find it within their means to pay this guy what he wants and probably what he deserves. Because heaven forbid, if they paid him more money, then they would have to justify that by giving him a bigger push, and we can't have that. So, epic fail on TNA's part, not keeping Amazing Red. That's not a huge loss, given that they weren't really pushing him at all. But it's still a big loss, and TNA's loss will be somebody else's gain. Unfortunately, I don't think it'll be WWE's gain, but it will be somebody else's gain. I want to give some quick thoughts on Raw here from last Monday before we move on to a few other items. Good, the bad, and the ugly. Not really a good, bad, the ugly review this week. I'm just going to kind of go through a couple of different points. I thought the show was good. It wasn't, you know, it really wasn't a great show. But the parts that were good, I think, made it a pretty good show. Fairly enjoyable. The best part of the show was the beginning of the show, which was the opening 25-minute segment. And you can argue that it went a little too long. For me, those 25 minutes went by like 10. And usually that's a telltale sign that what you're watching is pretty engaging and pretty entertaining, so I give it a thumbs up. I thought Punk and Triple H played their roles to near perfection in that opening segment. Triple H putting that little comment in there about the fact that, you know, in spite of my personal feelings about you, I want to do business the right way, so I decided to bring back CM Punk. And of course, Punk says, well, you know, despite your personal feelings, why don't you share with us what your personal feelings are? And then it just kind of went from there. Triple H said he's got a big ego. You know, at one point he threatened to smack the stupid tattoos off his body. Punk, of course, played into every internet fan who's ever bashed Triple H about being married to the boss's daughter and, you know, being on an ego trip and caring only about himself. And Triple H admitting, yeah, I got a big ego. And to be honest, everybody in wrestling has an ego. That's not limited to Triple H. It just so happens that Triple H has been in a position of power where he can use that. Believe me, if there were other people who had the same power Triple H had, they would be every bit as vilified by those internet wrestling fans that hate Triple H's guts for reasons that in some cases I can understand, and in other reasons I think it's just this unhealthy obsession. I think people hate just to hate, which is no big surprise when it comes to wrestling fans. That's just the way it's going to be. But in this segment, both these guys were fantastic, and clearly they're setting up for a match at some point. Is that going to be at Survivor Series? Can they actually hold this off long enough to build to a WrestleMania match between the two of them? I don't know. It certainly would be a WrestleMania-worthy match if it were their first encounter. I think you can build a WrestleMania match between these two just off the fact that they've never fought before, and you've got this personal issue. They could drag this out. You know, you don't want to have Punk and Triple H cutting promos on each other every week. They did this past week. If they do it every now and then, you drop little hints here and there, these two don't like each other, they don't get along, their relationship is just falling apart, it's getting worse, you could drag this on for another 6 or 8 months. Put it on the back burner and just build to a match at your biggest show of the year. I don't know if that's what they're doing, but that's what I would do. But again, just a fantastic segment. I enjoyed every part of it. The fact that it went 25 minutes of talking, I'm not a huge fan of 25 straight minutes of talking. In this case, it worked. It worked. And quite frankly, when looking at this show overall, it didn't look like they had anything better planned. So, thumbs up on that. Beth Phoenix wins the Battle Royal. They had a Divas Battle Royal. I mentioned it earlier. Gail Kim basically took herself out of the Battle Royal, I think, within the first 30 seconds. Beth had this great spot at the end where she had both Bella Twins up, one on each shoulder. And she held them up there for probably close to 10 seconds, and the crowd was going crazy. It was probably the biggest pop to a finish for any Divas match I've seen in a long time. People really loved this finish. She dumped both of them out, won the Battle Royal. Kelly, who was on commentary, came into the ring to congratulate Beth, and Beth promptly turned on Kelly Kelly, because Kelly is an idiot. Why would you come into the ring and want to be all buddy-buddy with Beth Phoenix, who just won a battle royal and wants to kick your ass and take your championship? So, of course, Kelly got her ass kicked appropriately. And I guess that was a Beth Phoenix heel turn. Either that or she's just showing a mean streak. But either way, this was really good stuff. First time in a long time I could say that about the Divas stuff on Raw. And by virtue of this battle royal going on as long as it did, it was also by default the longest Divas match we've had on Raw, probably in years. Tag team match, we have Rey Mysterio and John Morrison against R-Truth and Miz again. Very good. These four worked together. They gelled. It was a quick-paced match. I had nothing wrong with it at all. I thought it was a really enjoyable tag team match. What was not so enjoyable were the results of this bullshit survey that they showed from WWE.com. They took a poll earlier on in the show, and at the end they gave us the results on who the fans think is the real WWE champion, or who should be the WWE champion. Of course, is it John Cena, or is it CM Punk? And as far as I know, the results were legit. They were not worked. They were not fixed. A lot like the old Cyber Sunday shows, they were on the up and up. And John Cena won with 54% of the vote to CM Punk's 46. So, somewhat close, but you know what? Not really. That's still, you know, it wasn't like a 70-30 margin, but that's still a pretty dominant position. The fans think that John Cena should be and is the proper WWE champion. And to that I say, what the fuck are the members of this supposed universe that we live in smoking? This is the problem here. I talked about it last week. John Cena didn't even deserve a rematch for the championship, and yet people think he is the real WWE champion. So, like I said, whatever it is, pass it along. It's got to be some strong stuff that these people are imbibing on, because I don't know how you can, from a storyline perspective, I don't know how you can logically say that John Cena should be the champion more so than CM Punk, the guy that beat him clean in the middle of the ring on pay-per-view and took the championship from him in the first place. I just don't understand that. So then we had the final segment of the show, which was perhaps the most predictable segment that we've seen on Raw in ages, which was Triple H coming out to announce what he was going to do to resolve this situation. We had two WWE champions. How are we going to resolve the situation between John Cena and CM Punk? And surprise, surprise, what was the big announcement? Well, there's going to be a match at SummerSlam, champion against champion, to determine the undisputed WWE champion. To me, there'll always only be one undisputed champion. And no, I'm not talking about Chris Jericho. I'm talking about Randy Savage. To anybody who was not a fan back then, you need to go watch WrestleMania 4. The whole point was they were crowning an undisputed WWF champion. And Savage beat four guys in one night to take the title, which was more impressive than Chris Jericho, as far as I'm concerned. Granted, Savage was beating Butch Reed and Greg Valentine in one-man gang, whereas Jericho got wins over Rock and Steve Austin. But, you know, he did cheat to win, let's be honest. So, anyway, we're going to have a match at SummerSlam. Everybody and their mother already knew we were going to have a match at SummerSlam. Why they had to build this up through the whole show and make it like it was some sort of huge announcement that nobody else could have figured out, that was just a really lame way to end the show. And it just left a bad taste in my mouth between the predictable announcement and that stupid bullshit where both guys would hold up the titles and they played their music. I mean, boy, Vince is determined to get his money's worth out of that Cult of Personality theme song. I mean, they must have played that fucking song 8 different times on this show from start to finish. And I mean, it's a good song, but by the end, I just could not even listen to it anymore. But just the way they did that whole thing where one guy holds the belt up and the music guy plays his music and then the other guy holds it, it's just so fake. It's so phony, so stupid. I thought this ending sucked. And, you know, again, the reason is this is an angle that worked, at least at first, because it was based on something that was real. People felt that this was something real. CM Punk cutting a promo on Vince McMahon felt real. He was voicing real concerns. He might really leave the company. And now it's just become another wrestling angle. You know, and under normal circumstances, that's fine. In wrestling, you have angles. But this was supposed to be different. That's what made this whole thing special. Otherwise, it's just John Cena and CM Punk, and it doesn't mean shit. And when you have stupid endings like that, like what we saw on Raw, it just illustrates the fact that, again, I think it was a mistake to bring Punk back this early. And I had one person email me, and I don't remember who it was. I'll check my emails when we get to the mailbag. But one person wanted to know, well, since you thought Punk might have come back too early, how would you have handled the situation? And I think I've made that clear. How long you would keep Punk out for is up for interpretation. You could have kept him out a couple more weeks. You know, you could keep him out 6 months. I think it would have been somewhat unrealistic. Unless Punk really was adamant about taking time off, then perfect. Let him take time off, and when he's ready to come back, he's been gone for a couple of months. That could have worked out perfectly. Punk really did want to take time off initially, and then he got convinced to stay. I am not sure that giving him 3 or 4 months off wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world, quite frankly. Now, would it have been 3 or 4 months, 6 weeks, 8 weeks? I don't know. It would have been something longer than what they did is how long I would have kept him out for. And probably the way I would have worked it, you know, in the meantime, they're going to crown an interim WWE champion. Some people will look at that as legit. Some people will think it's bullshit. Obviously, the majority of the WWE universe would think that it's legit because they're idiots. And so at some point, maybe at the end of a pay-per-view main event in 2, 3, 4 months, you have Punk jump over the barricade. Maybe he's wearing a hooded sweatshirt, a hoodie or something, which Punk actually does wear in real life. He walks around Chicago wearing a hoodie. So he comes out of the crowd, looks like a fan is jumping over. He goes to attack Cena or do something, cause mayhem of some kind, and then it's pull the hood back, and you see that it's CM Punk, and the place goes crazy. And then from there, Punk is back, and you kind of portray him as this rebel without a cause. And over the course of several weeks, they attempt to re-sign him, and eventually he comes back, and things are back to normal. But, you know, you milk something like that. They really had something there. People saw Punk put a picture on his Twitter of the title sitting in a refrigerator, and they practically creamed themselves. It doesn't, you know, there's not a lot of effort involved to really get people excited about something like this. And I just feel like they rushed it. It's fine if you're going to rush something because you want to get to something better. Like, oh, let's get this over with because we got this great idea. But they don't. They don't have another great idea. This is the great idea, and it wasn't even their idea. It's just, they were working off circumstances beyond their control. It wasn't as though they wanted Punk to leave. They were working desperately to get Punk to stay, and this never would have even happened. It just kind of materialized. The best angles sometimes, the best scenarios just kind of fall on your lap. Look at the invasion in 2001. You know, WCW went out of business. WWE had a golden opportunity to make something happen. They made some money off it. They could have made a lot more. They bungled the biggest angle in the history of wrestling. And again, even that, some people would disagree with. I've stated my case on that numerous times. You know, they did well with that first invasion pay-per-view, and then they fucked the whole thing up as far as I'm concerned. And it's kind of a similar situation here. I fear that that's, not that this thing is ruined. I'm not abandoning all hope or anything like that. I'm actually trying to be very optimistic about this, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do in this match at SummerSlam. If they go in there and just have Cena get his win back and beat Punk clean, then I don't even know what to say. I mean, that would require a level of short-sightedness that I would like to think that WWE isn't even capable of. But I probably shouldn't say that. I do find it funny, though, that John Cena, you know, Triple H cannot wait. He cannot wait another week, you know, after Mysterio won the championship to give John Cena his rematch. Cena had to have his rematch, I guess, because he was somehow royally screwed at Money in the Bank. And yet, Rey Mysterio is relegated to tag team action and gets no such rematch on this show. I find that fascinating. We also had John Laryngitis. I've seen a lot of people refer to him as that. I will as well. Come out. Apparently he's going to be a TV character. There's a video, actually. If you go to WWE.com, it's up right now. They may show it on TV this week. I don't know. It's a sit-down interview with him. It's like a 2-minute clip. Basically, it gives you some insight into the career of Johnny Ace and what his current role is in WWE. And the way he smiles and smirks in this video, he actually, I think, there's some potential there. There's hope there for him to be that smarmy, kind of easily hateable authority figure, although his acting in this segment on Raw was just fucking atrocious. I mean, he was terrible. He was terrible. I mean, you talk about somebody who clearly looks like he's reading from a script, and this guy was just, if that was the goal of this segment, then Johnny Ace hit it out of the ballpark. I thought his delivery was terrible, but still, there's potential there for his character if he's going to be on TV going forward. One thing I think that needs to be addressed is the Raw General Manager situation. We did not hear anything about the Raw GM at all. I think the podium, people in the building claimed the podium was there. I don't remember seeing it at all, but apparently it was set up. The GM never dinged in. I don't think the GM has dinged in over 2 weeks now. And if they dropped the whole thing and never spoke of it again, I guess that would be fine. God knows it's run its course, but I just feel like you've had that fucking computer sitting there now for, what, well over a year. And there's been no resolution to the situation. I mean, granted, we were never told there would be a resolution. You know, the anonymous Raw GM was simply anonymous. Who says that we ever need to find out who it is? But I will say that if Johnny Ace, if John Laryngitis was revealed as the anonymous Raw GM, he would probably be the most logical choice at this point. And I almost wish they would just come out, like have Laryngitis come out on Raw next week to cut a promo. And just in passing, he mentions something to the effect of, and I was the Raw general manager, and people boo, and then you just move on. Like, even if you just completely disregard it and you just move on, at least you've mentioned it, you've given some closure to that stupid shit that we had to deal with week after week after week for over a year. So he would be a logical choice for that. And the last thing I just have to mention about Raw, and if I were doing Good, Bad, and Ugly, this would be a huge, huge ugly part of this show, is the announcing. Not even Jim Ross, the greatest announcer in the history of professional wrestling, could save the announcing on this show. Michael Cole is simply out of control. I mean, it's never, ever been this bad before. I mean, I always said that Duke Daugherty was the absolute worst person I've ever heard on commentary. And if you don't know who Duke Daugherty is, I bet most of you don't. I only became familiar with him through certain matches on older WWE Coliseum videos, and a lot of the content, even the older stuff from WWE 24/7, their video on demand channel. That guy, apparently he was a journeyman wrestler, I think up in the Boston, New England area. He was kind of a jobber, basically, and for whatever reason, they put him on commentary sometimes. This guy was, I thought, up until now, the dirt worst I have ever heard on commentary. I mean, he had this, it's not even raspy voice, this very jagged, sharp, just grating like nails on a goddamn chalkboard. This guy was the pits. I mean, he was terrible, and yet I actually think that I may have to rethink that position as far as worst announcer ever, because Michael Cole, he just makes the product so much worse than it really is. At least Duke Daugherty was just a terrible announcer with a really bad voice. He had no business doing announcing, but it wasn't like he was ruining the product. It wasn't like he was being a detriment to business in WWE. In this case, Michael Cole, I think, is having an adverse effect, quite frankly, on ratings and business for WWE. He talks over everybody. You know, he falls in and out of his heel character on a whim. He can't even be consistent with it. He'll rant on pointless things out of the blue that have absolutely no bearing on what's going on in the ring, and he's not even funny. I mean, at least when Bobby Heenan used to do it, it was fucking funny. But this guy just rambles on and on has nothing to do with what's going on TV. You know, Jim Ross tries to make a comment. He starts railing on Jim Ross. And again, I understand that it's Vince McMahon who's doing this. I get that, you know, when it comes to bashing JR. I can't even blame Cole for that. But I can blame Cole for everything else. Maybe he's just too good at his job. His job is to be a heel, to be as annoying as possible. And if that's the case, then Michael Cole is fantastic at his job. But he also needs to go, because he's just making things so much worse. I was so excited to see Jim Ross back, and now I don't even care. I don't care whether JR stays and goes, and quite frankly, it would almost be good for him if he left. Because he's just going to go out there every week and get embarrassed and made fun of. He'll try to make a point to make a match better, and Cole will just step all over him. I mean, I thought the whole point of bringing Jim Ross back was to bring some credibility back to the announce booth. Or maybe at the end of a Raw show, when you're trying to give the hard sell on a go-home show to a match like Punk and Cena, you'd have JR there as the guy that, you know, he doesn't have to go crazy and orgasmic the way he used to at the end of those shows when he would yell and scream and stuff. But JR can, I mean, the guy sells barbecue sauce by the box. You know, he could sell ice to an Eskimo. He's very good at his job. He can convince people that this is the biggest match you're ever going to see, and you should pay your $45 to see it. But he'll try to make that point, and Michael Cole will just completely step all over him and just ruin the whole damn thing. It's just really, really bad. And I don't watch as much of SmackDown, but even from what I've heard on SmackDown, Cole is no better on that show. And I've complained about Booker T before, but Cole is so much worse in that he has a detrimental effect on business. There are people who will send feedback into SE Scoops and other wrestling websites who claim that they don't even watch the show now because of him, or they have to flip the channel when he's on, or they watch it on mute, so they don't get the benefit of any announcing at all, even the good announcing that there may be. I mean, people are fed up with the Michael Cole act. He either has to drop it or get the fuck out, because these shows are almost intolerable. When he gets going on those rants, it is just insufferable. Colt Cabana had a dark match at the SmackDown tapings on Tuesday, lost to Wade Barrett. I saw people get upset about that. I don't know what people are getting so upset about. It was a dark match. Most people in their dark matches, especially if it's a tryout, they don't win. So, I mean, that doesn't bother me at all. Wade Barrett is an established performer, a former main event performer, in fact, in WWE, former Intercontinental Champion. He should be beating Colt Cabana in a dark match, but I haven't heard what their opinion or thoughts on him were. I don't think he was awful to the point where they refused to give him a job or anything, but whether or not they were impressed enough to offer him a contract, I have not heard. I hope it works out for him. I really do. I don't know that he would have gotten this tryout were it not for everything that's happened over the last several weeks with CM Punk, so he probably owes his friend a big debt of gratitude, and I know that for all the complaints he had about when he was in WWE, and Cabana has a lot of outside interest. He has his own podcast called The Art of Wrestling. He has his own merchandise that he sells on his website, Colt Merch, or I think ilovecolt.com. He's, you know, wrestling independents all over the country, all over the world. In fact, I believe he was just over in the UK. So he's keeping busy. I mentioned before that documentary that he came out with, The Wrestling Road Diaries, which I've got about 90 minutes left of it to watch, but what I've seen so far of him and Bryan Danielson on the road, and they're in his final days of Ring of Honor, and they're going to different independent shows across the country. It's really entertaining, and it's worth a purchase. But despite all of that, Punk has expressed, or rather Colt has expressed, an interest in coming back to WWE. He wants a second chance. He wants a second chance to prove that he can make money, and he can be one of the more entertaining acts on television. I've been singing the guy's praises for years, you know, and a year or two ago when I remember talking about Punk, and I even said back then, when Punk was walking around with the Money in the Bank briefcase, when he had won Money in the Bank, it was either the first time or the first time, that I thought they should bring Cabana in at that time and pair him off with Punk, almost as a lackey, which is fine. You know, you can bring a character like Cabana in as a lackey, and then over time, he grows into his own. Bringing him in to work with Punk as a lackey, where Punk would make him hold the briefcase and walk around with it. I mean, these were ideas I was coming up with for Cabana years ago. And so if this dark match results in something tangible for him, maybe he gets a second chance, another contract offer. Hopefully he would bypass developmental and they'd have something for him on TV. I think that would be fantastic. It would truly be, to me anyway, a feel-good story of a guy who reached the big time, unfortunately was not given a fair shake, had a scratch and claw his way back up and get his name out there, got a second chance and took advantage of it, and I hope things work out for him. Update on the Sin Cara situation. There's been a lot of news and notes about him over the last couple of days. Now, you may recall that Sin Cara was suspended by World Wrestling Entertainment back on July 18th, the day after the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, when Sheamus just destroyed him at the pay-per-view and put him through a ladder. And the storyline injury that he suffered was going to keep him out for 4 weeks, conveniently the same length of time that he would have been suspended for, which was 30 days. And apparently he's being advertised for SmackDown this upcoming Friday, which is August 12th, which is not exactly 30 days. So what's going on here? Apparently, WWE, for whatever reason, could simply not wait to reintroduce this character on TV for 30 days, even though if they would just wait one more week, they can bring him back, no problem. Apparently, they're at least thinking about bringing him back to TV this week, but not having the same person under the mask. So the same person that has portrayed Sin Cara from day one, the same person who, for the most part, portrayed the Mystico character in Mexico for years, the guy that got over and ultimately got the contract with WWE, will not be the guy under the mask if he indeed does wrestle on TV this week. The belief is that it will be another performer who's been toiling in developmental now for, I can't even say months, I think the guy has been down there for years, another former Mexican performer under the name of Junico. Junico may be under the Sin Cara mask this week, portraying the character, possibly only for 1 week until the other guy comes back. So again, if that's the case, I don't understand why you have to bring him back this week. I mean, it's not like the guy's set for a match at SummerSlam. and this is the go home week, all the go home shows for the pay per view. Why not run vignettes that promote his return for SmackDown the week after SummerSlam and just bring the regular guy back in the role? Unless you're going to fire him and just put somebody else under the mask permanently, but I don't think that's what they're doing. So if they do this, I don't know. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Ironically, if stories are to be believed, the person who plays Junico actually did play Mystico down in Mexico at least once or twice back in the day. And there are other stories about, Mystico was a big, big, big star. I mean, he was the John Cena of Mexico for many years. I mean, he was selling out buildings and just business was booming with him as the top star. And the problem is that he was overbooking himself. He was double booking himself sometimes to the point where he couldn't be. I mean, you can't be in more than one place at a time. So his brother, who I don't know if he still does. At one point, he played the character down in Mexico known as Astro Boy. The belief, I don't know if anybody ever actually proved it, but the belief was that Astro Boy was doubling as Mystico at some of those shows, and it wasn't the real Mystico, because he was booking himself in so many different places, trying to make as much money as he could, but couldn't actually be under the mask at all these places, so he kind of had his brother play the role. And apparently Junico played the role a couple of times down in Mexico as well, so it's kind of appropriate if he was to portray Sin Cara even for a week. On WWE, it would actually be kind of ironic, given that it would not be the first time that has happened. WWE had a conference call on Thursday of this week to announce their second quarter numbers and results. The WrestleMania numbers were in there. They made a lot of money, basically. They were down in some areas and flat in others. Nothing overly terrific. Vince McMahon did mention just some of the more important points. By the way, Vince McMahon was not asked the question about Randy Savage, which I'm sure makes Luis from Illinois very upset. But he did talk about Money in the Bank, and that the preliminary numbers for the July pay-per-view indicate that Money in the Bank was up 20% from last year, which is actually something of a disappointment compared to what some people were predicting that show would do. Because the actual numbers are not yet in, we can't really say exactly what a 20% increase would mean. Does that mean that it got 150,000 buys domestically? 150,000 buys worldwide would be awful, because that would translate into far fewer domestic buys. So if it's 20% higher, if it's better than last year, then that's a good thing. But there were a lot of people who thought this pay-per-view, not that it would have done WrestleMania numbers, not by any means, but it was going to do a lot better than a typical B-show WWE pay-per-view. And at least at this point, it appears that it only did a little bit better. And I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure what that says. If the lesson here is that no matter what you do, you will simply never get more than a certain threshold of people to buy your lesser shows, no matter what they do. I don't know if that's true. But if ever there was a pay-per-view, I think that would have gotten people excited enough to want to spend their money to see that match between Cena and Punk, this show would have been it. And I'm not sure that a 20% increase is all that great, but, an increase is an increase. Vince also said that they are in talks, and I mentioned this one time before, and this is the first time I've heard Vince McMahon flat out say this, that they are in talks with USA Network for a potential live one-hour pre-show that would air from 8 to 9 before Raw every Monday night, which would give us a permanent three-hour block of WWE programming each and every Monday night beginning at 8 p.m. And I don't know about this. I was not a fan of Tough Enough being on at 8 o'clock every week. I talked about that at the time. I just thought it was too much. I love Tough Enough, and unfortunately it doesn't look like Tough Enough is coming back, because I would assume if it was, we would have heard by now. And if they're in talks with USA about a completely different one-hour show, then my guess is Tough Enough is not coming back, at least not on USA. But I just, 3 hours every single week, 3 hours straight, it's just too much. It's too much. And, if what they're going for is kind of a pre-show version of what TNA Reaction was, and I thought TNA Reaction was one of the few things TNA did that was actually pretty cool. The way that show was shot, it was only half an hour or an hour? I think it was an hour. When in reality, it should have been half an hour. But I enjoyed the concept a lot. And if this is going to be kind of a pre-show version of that, I think that's a good thing. But, to do it every single week before Raw, I don't know about that. That's just too much wrestling all at once. I mean, 3 hours of Nitro is one of the things. Believe me, it wasn't the only thing, but it was one of the things that sped up the demise of WCW. You know, when Nitro went from, originally it was 1 hour to 2 hours, and then of course WWE followed suit and Raw became 2 hours, so 2 hours became the standard of what a wrestling show should be, at least on Monday nights. But then Nitro went to 3 hours, and that's when things started to take a nosedive, because it's very difficult to fill 3 hours of television with good quality programming every week and keep people engaged. I mean, whenever WWE does a 3 hour Raw show, that first hour, no matter how hard they promote it in advance, either because people forget or people simply think 3 hours is too much, it always does less. In some cases, far less. And it drags the overall ratings average of the show down by doing that. So, you know, if we're used to seeing Raw do a 3-1, 3-2, 3-3 every week, and it goes permanently to 3 hours, then let's not be surprised if Raw starts pulling in a 2-8, 2-9, 3-0 every week. I don't know if they realize that, that probably is what would happen. And quite frankly, I don't know that a WWE show at that hour would do better than the NCIS reruns and those other shows they typically put on before Raw. I'm actually kind of surprised if USA actually goes through with it. But the concept I like, the idea of it, though, I'm not a big fan of. I just think 3 hours is too much. I'm not saying that if they go to 3 hours, Raw will die and WWE will cease to exist within 6 months. I do think the company is run a lot better and a lot more fluidly than WCW was. And WCW had a lot of problems beyond just 3 hours of Nitro. But it was not a good thing. It was a detriment to the company. I think 3 hours every Monday night would be a detriment to WWE. One final note here before I get into some of your questions. You may recall a couple of weeks back, there was a photo floating around on the internet. I believe I actually posted it on our Facebook page as well. A photo that looked to be fairly recent of what appeared to be The Undertaker in an airport, waiting for somebody, bald. He had this weird-looking top hat. It wasn't a cowboy hat. It was just this weird-looking like top hat on, and it appeared that under the hat, he had no hair. And there were people who thought, well, maybe he's got his hair done up in like a bonnet. I think somebody actually sent me a reply on Twitter and said to me, we were talking about this, and my response to him was, well, maybe he's got his hair up in a bun. And we can call it the underbun. Yeah, that's why I'm not a stand-up comedian. But, you know, maybe it was just the angle that the photo was taken. Maybe the photo was bullshit. And apparently, based on a note in this week's issue of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, a source within WWE has confirmed that Undertaker did, in fact, shave his head. Not sure why. I guess he just felt like he wanted to shave it, and he shaved his head. So we have a bald Undertaker. Because even if Undertaker doesn't come back until right before WrestleMania next year, there ain't no way that he's going to be able to grow his hair back out to those lengths. And who knows? I mean, maybe Undertaker isn't going to have a match at WrestleMania next year. You know, maybe he's going to take a year off and try for 30-0 sometime later on. Or 30-0, my God, 20-0. But here's my take on the situation. And I don't want to sound like, you know, I'm being a curmudgeon on this or anything like that, but you know, there's a rule. I've heard wrestlers talk about it in interviews and stuff like that. There's been a lot of wrestlers who have, over the years, been asked by the promoter or flat out told that they're going to have their hair cut off or their head shaved in a match. You know, like a stipulation, a hair match. You can draw some money off it or pop a rating. You know, they did that years ago with Chris Jericho and Kevin Nash. It was kind of a big deal. Jericho beat Nash on Raw and then cut his hair. He didn't really shave Nash's head. He gave him a nice little haircut. That was when Nash got a crew cut for the role in the Punisher movie that he did. But there's been a lot of examples. And then there's been other wrestlers that have done interviews over the years that have just, you know, they've expressed absolutely no interest. And there are wrestlers that have left promotions, I'm sure, because of that. My whole thing is this. Just imagine, if you will, for a moment, if Undertaker came back a little bit early. So we're not talking WrestleMania here. Came back a little bit early, maybe Royal Rumble, and had a match, a feud with somebody, came back, and this heel, this dastardly heel, shaved the Undertaker bald. He cut his hair off, shaved his head on TV for the entire world to see, just embarrassed him in front of the world. He did something that nobody ever thought they would see. I mean, I know Undertaker, you know, got a haircut years ago when he was the big evil character. You know, he basically cut all of his hair off. But just forget that ever happened for a second. Find a young heel who can get over by shaving The Undertaker bald on TV. I think that would get over huge. I think people would just be incensed if they saw The Undertaker getting his head shaved. It would be a big deal, because it's not something any of us, I think, at this point in his career, ever thought we would see. So at least then you can try to make some money off it. You know, maybe this guy is going to be the guy that faces Undertaker at WrestleMania ultimately and loses. But in the meantime, he has an initial match with Undertaker and beats him. Maybe it's a hair versus hair stipulation. Maybe it's a regular match, and the guy just decides to shave Undertaker bald after the match just to kind of insult him and add insult to injury. And, you know, you can help put somebody on the map by doing something like that. I don't know who you would pick. I'd have to go through the whole SmackDown roster and see. Or maybe it would be an interesting way to introduce a new talent from OVW, or rather FCW, I should say. I'd have to think about this a little bit, but I just feel like it's kind of a wasted opportunity in a way. For a hair match, you know, to either pop a rating or do some business or just help get somebody over, because there's very few things I think in wrestling that you could do these days that are truly shocking. And maybe I'm wrong, maybe wrestling has just changed so much that even this wouldn't mean anything to anybody, but I refuse to believe that. I think there are still things that you can do that would resonate with people and give them that oh my god reaction and make them want to see somebody get their ass kicked by the other guy. And I just think Undertaker is a legend. He has the respect of pretty much everybody, every fan, whether you like him or not. And he's in a league of his own, one of the greatest of all time in the company. And if you do the angle right, you don't play it for comedy, you do it right, and you have somebody shave him bald, cut off all of his hair in the middle of the ring, the officials run down, Kane runs down, you know, oh my God, what's happening to my brother? If you handle it right, this could have meant something huge. So I just think, in a way, it's kind of a waste. I mean, Undertaker, hey, he's a big boy. He can do whatever he wants. You know, he wants to shave his head, shave his head. You know, who is WWE to say that he's not allowed to do that? I just think I'm somewhat surprised that somebody in Undertaker's position wouldn't have said, you know what, we might be able to actually do something with this. I want to shave my head, but why don't we make an angle out of it? You know, why don't I come back? I don't even have to wrestle a match. You know, if Undertaker is still hurt, he's that beat up, he can't wrestle a full match, bring him back for an angle. Pretend that Undertaker is coming back, and then he gets his ass kicked by somebody, and then he gets his head shaved or something. So, anyway, that's my spiel on that. Apparently, it's legit, and I don't know what he's going to look like when he comes back, but I'm sure it's going to look it's going to be a little weird, I think, if Undertaker did, in fact, shave his head. All right, it's time for my favorite part of the show. I don't know about you guys, but it's time for the mailbag. We got a lot of good questions from you guys this week. This comes from Trust, Dear Solid Monster. Just watching Raw last week and saw John Cena doing a promo, and again, it was terrible. So it got me thinking, what if WWE were to give Cena an indefinite microphone ban? Kind of like what WCW did with Goldberg when he first came through. I think it would help refresh John's character. What do you think? At first, when I read this question, my first thought was to say, are you high? John Cena, like him or not, is the top star in your company. He's the WWE champion. And while his promos may more often than not just make the hair on the back of my neck stand up, it's his job, part of his job, to get on the microphone and try to sell people on the big pay-per-view match with Punk or the big pay-per-view match with whoever it may be. And you're talking about putting him on an indefinite microphone ban. That sounds pretty ridiculous. But when I thought about it a little bit more, I wouldn't do it quite like, you know, you gave Goldberg as an example. Just having Cena not be allowed to talk is kind of stupid. But if Cena was to somehow be wronged, you know, let's just say hypothetically, after Money in the Bank, John Cena was beaten and embarrassed. He'd lost the WWE Championship. He caused all of this. Punk leaving, even though Punk came back a week later. So let's just say, hypothetically speaking, that John Cena didn't just show up on the next show all happy and you know, as joyous as he always is, smiling, got his rematch and just won the championship back, just like that. Instead of that happening, let's just say that Cena showed up on TV the next night, and he was angry. And no microphone, no silly jokes, no silly promo. He doesn't say a word. He just comes out, he's got this really stern look on his face, comes out and just starts beating the crap out of people. You know, he's angry. He wants Punk, and if he can't get Punk, he's going to do whatever it takes to get Punk to come back. and he's going to beat people up, and we're going to see a side of John Cena that we have never seen before. And by virtue of doing this angle, we're not going to have him speak. That I could see. Now, that's not going to be permanent. That would only be for a couple of weeks, maybe a month, something like that. But I actually think that would be a hell of an idea. Of course, that's not what happened. And I don't ever, ever, ever see them even considering an idea like that, because God forbid we should keep the microphone away from John Cena. But I think if he handled it like that, that would actually be a pretty cool little idea. And it would freshen the character up a little bit. Got an email here from Ben, not with a question, but this kind of plays off what I was talking about last week about the automatic rematch clause, how stupid it is, and I gave some early examples of it, trying to figure out exactly how far it dates back. And again, with the understanding that I'm sure there's been examples that go back 7, 8, 9 years of it, but in terms of when it consistently started. But Ben did write in with an example, one of the earliest examples from this era that he can remember, when something like this was referenced. And it was right around the time Brock Lesnar was still in WWE. It was during his first face run, when he was facing the Big Show, and they had all those battles and were just beating the crap out of each other. Just completely destroyed their bodies during that feud. And Paul Heyman had screwed Lesnar over, showed chokeslam Lesnar on a chair to win the title. That, of course, was at Survivor Series. The next night on SmackDown, Heyman, who apparently was no longer Lesnar's manager at this point, said in a promo that not only did he screw Brock Lesnar out of the championship, but he did not write a rematch clause into the match contract. And the way that Heyman said this apparently made it seem to Ben, anyway, as though this was the norm back at that time. So Lesnar, therefore, could not get his rematch against the Big Show. So that would be one of the earlier examples that Ben was able to find of this supposed automatic rematch bullshit, which I still don't agree with, but thank you for finding that. Sam from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Since Zack Ryder now has a full-size and unique internet championship belt and not a kid's toy, do you feel that he will be allowed to come to the ring with it? Obviously, it would be just for him and not be counted as an actual title to contend for. I feel it would add to his character and be something different, kind of shades of the $1 million title back in the day. Funny thing is, it's better looking than the actual WWE Championship. Just wanted to know your thoughts on this. By the way, if you have not seen Zack Ryder's new Internet Championship belt, he had one before. It was basically a kid's replica of the Intercontinental title, and he put some plates over it that had like a Facebook logo and a Twitter logo. I thought it was pretty neat. And on one of the more recent episodes of his web show, the Z True Long Island Story, he ditched the belt and brought a new championship belt, a new internet title into the fold that looks phenomenal. I mean, this belt is really, really cool. It was custom designed. It's just, you got to see this thing. It's huge, it's cool, and I absolutely agree. It looks 10 times better than the current WWE championship. At first, I thought it was just a UFC title that had some plates put over it, but it looks like a custom-made championship belt. And I'll tell you what, it just goes to show you the dedication that this guy has. Supposedly, he spent his own money to have it made. That had to have cost him at least $1,500 to $2,000. And you can call him a mark. You can call him a lot of things. He probably is a mark. But I love the guy because he has this passion that's just infectious. I mean, he's doing all this shit on his own. He has to come up every single week with original content for his show, which, trust me, is not an easy thing to do. You know, on his days off from the road, he's working full-time on that show. He bought that championship belt because he thought it would enhance his character. At some point, I would love to see him with that title on TV. You know what? They've done it before with DiBiase and the $1 million belt. You know, Taz did it with the FTW title and ECW, and there's been other custom belts over the years. I don't see anything wrong with it at all, quite frankly, and even if he starts defending it on some of the lower shows, you know, he wants to defend it on Superstars or something. He wants to even just hold it with him on SmackDown every week when he's Teddy Long's assistant to the general manager position, whatever. The fact is, it's a cool-looking title, and it's a gimmick. I mean, that's really what it is. But I think I would love to see it on TV. I wouldn't have a problem with it at all. MDS from Anchorage, Alaska writes in, "Dear Solomon, I've been catching the sound off since episode 130. Just finished listening last week, having fun on the Facebook's page. I wanted to just say what's up, and I'm a fan. Much love to you and SE Scoops. Might as well ask a question. Just curious, how many Facebook friends do you have from Alaska?" And the honest answer to that question is, I don't know. So anybody who's listening right now who's from anywhere in the state of Alaska, if you are, in fact, a fan of the Sound Off and a friend on Facebook, email me or post on Facebook. Just go ahead and post on the wall, and let's find out how many native Alaskans we have there. Maybe we have somebody from Wasilla who can share some news about a certain someone up there. Got a letter here from Hussam all the way over in Saudi Arabia. Dear Solemn Monster, I'm writing this to you while listening to episode 170. Just to correct you on one point, Chris Benoit did actually wrestle Randy Orton the Raw after SummerSlam in 04 for the title, so he did in fact use that rematch clause, which you're correct. I believe I used Benoit as an example of that last week. Benoit did in fact get a rematch after that show, but again, my point still stands. The stipulation sucks. I have two questions, he says. The first one being, what was the venue for the famous Andre vs. Hogan cage match at WrestleFest 87, and that would have been Milwaukee County Stadium in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was actually an outdoor stadium where they had that event. It's somewhat rare. I actually have a copy of it on DVD, and I thought the Hogan-Andre cage match was actually much better than their WrestleMania 3 match earlier that year. And Hogan won, obviously, but that was the location, and unfortunately, Milwaukee County Stadium is no more. It was demolished in 2001, so it doesn't exist anymore. And the other question, did the big summer events that WWE held in the summers of 86 and 87, the big event, inspire WWE to start the SummerSlam pay-per-view concept? I don't think they actually had a lot to do with SummerSlam coming about in 88. I think that had more to do with the expansion of pay-per-view. Again, there was no Royal Rumble pay-per-view until 89, but the first Royal Rumble event, as it would become known, was a USA Network special in 88. And the reason they did the Rumble was, you know, there was a lot of competition at the time between Crockett Promotions, you know, basically what would later become WCW, and WWE. There was a lot of back and forth. They did the Rumble special on USA. They set a ratings record for it at that time. Then Crockett had some Clash of the Champions events. There was one in particular that ran head-to-head with WrestleMania 4, and there was a whole brouhaha where Vince McMahon threatened to pull WrestleMania from certain providers if they, were airing certain events. That was actually a different event, but there was a lot of back and forth at the time, and really what Vince McMahon wanted to do was he wanted to make as much money as possible. He saw the writing on the wall. He saw the potential there with pay-per-view, and that really was the reason for it. It didn't have a lot to do with, well, you know, this event that we did in 86 did so well that let's do a SummerSlam pay-per-view next year or in 2 years. And it had everything to do with just how pay-per-view was evolving. And they were doing a lot of closed-circuit programming at the time, and they just decided that it was time to move on from that and make more money. And obviously it was the right way to go, and WWE had a lot of success with those early shows. You know, and in many respects, their success came at the expense of Crockett Promotions, which quite frankly couldn't keep up. And we all know what ended up happening. Ted Turner came into the picture, and the rest is history. Dylan writes in to the Sound Off here. Dear Solemn Monster, huge fan of the podcast, been listening since the summer of 08. Can I get a birthday shout out on this week's episode of the Sound Off? Happy birthday, Dylan. I also have a question to follow. What matches do you think should be on a CM Punk DVD if WWE eventually makes one? Well, obviously, I think there's one match in particular that needs to be on there. That would be Money in the Bank, probably Punk's best match ever in WWE. Maybe one of the best matches, quite frankly, he ever had in his career. And that includes all of those great matches he had in Ring of Honor. He went an hour once, at least, with Samoa Joe. Those were great matches, but this was on a completely different level. So obviously that match would be on there. At least one, I think, of his Money in the Bank ladder match victories at WrestleMania should be on there. Probably his first ECW title win on Sci-Fi over John Morrison should be on there. One or two of the great matches he had in his feud with Rey Mysterio should absolutely be on there. I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch, but those are some that come off the top of my head. Matt writes into the Sound Up, Dear Solemn Monster, there's been a somewhat famous story surrounding Owen Hart and Steve Austin after the broken neck incident at SummerSlam in 97. Is it true that Owen didn't call Austin afterwards? I have a hard time believing this because I've always heard that Owen was a pretty popular guy backstage. Also, on the DVD documentary The Life and Death of Owen Hart, there's some backstage footage of Owen after that match, and he looks pretty shaken up. To the best of your knowledge, why didn't he personally contact Austin after the incident? I don't know why. And as far as I know, it is legit. I remember hearing Bret Hart comment about it and how even Bret kind of had to talk to Owen about it and tell him that either he should reach out to Steve or he was wrong for not reaching out to Steve sooner. I don't have an answer as far as why he wouldn't have done it. Owen was very popular. I mean, he was well known for his ribs and practical jokes, but he was a very well-respected, nice guy. He wasn't, you know, unless you were just burned by one of his practical jokes, he really wasn't a dick. He was a you know, big family man and got along, I think, with pretty much everybody behind the scenes and was pretty well-liked universally. Maybe, you know, unless you're in a situation like that yourself, you don't know how you're going to react. Maybe he felt overly guilty and felt that it would be inappropriate for some reason when that's probably the opposite of how he should have felt. I know Steve Austin was not happy about it. And I even remember when Owen died, and they had Austin go out there on Raw the next night to do the salute at the very end of the show, to hold up the can of beer to toast the memory of Owen Hart, and remembering how awkward it was because Austin was not really friendly with Owen at that time. There was still a lot of lingering heat and lingering bad blood from what happened at SummerSlam, not just the injury itself, but also the follow-up and the fact that Owen either didn't call Steve or just didn't seem to show a lot of interest in following up with him and expressing remorse over what happened. So it is legit. I don't know why Owen reacted the way that he did, and unfortunately he's not around anymore for us to ask him that question. He would be the best person to ask. Chris Foster writes into the Sound Off. Dear Solemn Monster, I have two questions. First up, you said last week you thought CM Punk returned too early and that you would have done it differently. How so? I already answered that. That was the question I talked about a little bit earlier. And second, what would be a better match, CM Punk against Y2J at WrestleMania 28 or Punk against Stone Cold? Well, it's got to be Punk and Stone Cold. I mean, come on. I'm sure Punk and Jericho would have a hell of a match, quite frankly. I think they would work well. In fact, they had a match at least one time that I can remember, unless I'm completely making this up, on an episode of Raw that was pretty damn good. And I'm sure that a feud and the microphone work, the promo work between the two of them would be phenomenal. And Jericho is you know, he's close enough to Punk where Punk confides in him a lot. And Punk has gotten a lot of advice, apparently, on this whole angle from Jericho directly. Jericho's almost been coaching him on certain aspects of this angle, which, again, is why it made me chuckle when I saw all these people who were angry at Chris Jericho. And Jericho made that comment on Twitter after Punk mentioned his name last week. And Jericho went on Twitter, and he seemed to be all angry. He's like, you know, I heard Punk mention my name. He's like, I don't give a shit. Stop stealing my stuff. The fact that people bought into that and thought that, you know, Jericho was lashing out and he really disliked CM Punk, it just made me laugh. Because the polar opposite, it just could not be further from the truth. But as far as, you know, would I rather see Punk and Jericho or Punk and Austin? I mean, come on, there's no comparison. Punk and Austin, to me, much like Rock Cena, it's one of those few kind of fantasy matches that are left. And in a lot of ways, it's almost like then and now. You know, the Attitude Era against the current generation. You've got Rock and Cena already lined up for WrestleMania. And Stone Cold is one of the biggest CM Punk fans around. He's a huge Punk supporter. Paul Heyman is a huge Punk supporter. They've spoken glowingly about him in interviews and on Twitter and such. And if Austin has at least one more match left in his body, I think him and Punk, as great as Punk is, and Punk can bump for people, and Punk can make other people look good, it's one of the things that, as a heel, you have to know how to do. And I think they would have a tremendous match. And the build-up to that match, the promo work, and just the whole idea of, here's the beer-swilling, you know, foul-mouthed SOB against the straight-laced, the non-drinking, straight-edge superstar. It just sells itself. You know, the match sells itself. I would love to see Punk and Austin before I see Punk and Jericho. Richard writes into the podcast, Your Solemn Monster, Richard from New York City, that is. He's been listening since episode 38, so he's one of our longtime listeners, been a part of the Sound Off cult that subscribes on iTunes, is a friend on Facebook, and follows on Twitter. I believe that would be the Triple Threat. Thank you for mentioning that. I was wondering if you can give me a birthday shout-out on Sound Off, since today, August 7th, is my 18th birthday. How about that? So, happy birthday, Richard. 18's a good age. You are now a voting age, my friend. It's too bad you couldn't vote in Long Island for whether or not the Islanders should get a new stadium in the area or not. That was voted down, which doesn't bode well for the future of the beloved Nassau Coliseum. That Coliseum may not be here after 5 more years or so. We'll see what happens with that. But anyway, he's having a debate, Richard says, with a cousin of his. Was wondering if we can settle it here on the Sound Off. Since both WWE champions are going head-to-head at SummerSlam to unify the titles, do you think they will call it the Undisputed WWE Championship and finally unveil a new belt? And if it is unified, do you think they will leave SmackDown's title as is, or will they have another unification match sometime in the future, possibly at Night of Champions? Well, forget the unification thing. I first heard rumors of that before WrestleMania, that WrestleMania was going to feature a main event that was going to unify the two titles, and then they changed their mind. Then they went back to the idea, changed their mind again. I just don't see it happening as far as unifying the Raw and SmackDown belts into one. As far as whether or not we're finally going to get a new physical championship at SummerSlam or after SummerSlam, I just don't see it. I think if we were going to get one, we would have gotten it by now. I find it ironic that John Cena apparently was asked on Twitter. He's been answering some questions recently, and he actually responded to somebody who sent in a question about the belt. And Cena's response was that he has been fighting for a while, or so he claims, to get a new championship belt. And for whatever reason, WWE has turned him down, or they haven't gotten him an answer. He could just be saying that to kind of get back in the good graces of some of the people who rag on him for that crappy belt. But that's what he says. That's what Cena claims. And so I find that telling, that even if Cena himself wants a new belt, they won't give him one. I'm not sure what the resistance is on that issue, but I think they're going to probably just stick with the same belt, unfortunately. I really do, and God knows we can use a new one. Again, when the fake internet championship from one of your lower mid-card guys is better looking than your supposed, you know, the most prized possession in the industry today, something's wrong. Anyway, Richard said, loves the show. Keep up the stupendous, he says. An incredible job you do every week. You give me a reason to look forward to Sundays and the newest Sound Off. Shelby, an excellent birthday present from you to me. P.S. I was the one who tweeted you the YouTube video about the Brock Lesnar rumor response. Yeah, Richard did a YouTube video. He's done a couple of them. He's pretty good in them. You might want to check that out. I had responded to one of his tweets a couple of days ago, and you can go through that and find a link to the video. He did a video kind of mocking people in a way who actually believed in the internet bullshit rumors that Brock Lesnar was returning at SummerSlam. People are gullible. We know this. They'll believe anything. Don't believe everything you read, people. It's just some rumors are you know, you can go either way on them, and then some rumors are just complete and utter bullshit. And the fact that as many people believed in that rumor as did is actually somewhat frightening. And lastly here, Steve from New Jersey writes in, "Dear Solemn Monster, finally have access to an iPod, so I'm now a member of the Triple Threat. Congratulations. My question is, what is your opinion of Kevin Kelly saying in an interview about CM Punk that he is not the best in the world until he beats Davey Richards?" Now, Kevin Kelly, for those of you who don't know, Kevin Kelly once upon a time was a backstage announcer in WWE. He was actually a play-by-play guy for a brief period of time on Raw in WWE back in 96. He was very good at his job. He was the guy that Rock would make fun of and called him Hermie, would make him stick his finger up his nose every now and then. Very entertaining. And Kevin Kelly is now the play-by-play guy for Ring of Honor Wrestling. So he was interviewed recently, as Steve mentioned, was asked about the CM Punk angle, and said, "Punk is great and all, but he ain't the best in the world until he beats Davey Richards." So what is my reaction to this? Well, my reaction to this is the only reaction I could possibly have to a question like this. It's a work. Somebody needs to tell Kevin Kelly that it's fake. It's not real. He needs to calm down. I'll tell you what's not fake or phony. You guys have had some great questions for me over the last couple of weeks. I want to see more of them. Keep them coming in. Email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. All one word, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter. I actually just moved to the new Twitter. I was one of the last holdouts. I still have the old version of Twitter that I was rocking, and then they kept telling me, "Oh, you know, you're going to be forced to use the new one soon." And I'm like, "Well, I guess I'm going to wait until you force me." And, well, they forced me. So I'm liking it so far. It ain't bad. But anyway, friend me on there. Follow me, whatever it's called. And you can friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolemonster. All one word. Like I said, by the time you listen to this, we may already have cracked 1,000 friends. Or maybe not. Maybe you'll be number 1,000. So you want to get on there right now. There's never been a better time to get on there. There's a lot of fun stuff. Links, comments. We get some live blogging going during Raw every Monday night. I post some photos in the, quote, secret files every now and then that only Facebook friends have access to. All that good stuff. So facebook.com/TheSolemonster. Of course, you could also subscribe to the show in iTunes. Just type in Solemonster Sounds Off, the full title of the show, the proper title of the show. And it should come right up. Leave some feedback on there, too, if you want to. And if you do, subscribe in iTunes, friend me on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter. You are officially part of the Triple Threat. I did have one person in their email, I don't remember who it was, who I think was only a Twitter and Facebook follower, but not iTunes or something, and he called himself part of the Solemonster's Double Trouble, which I thought was actually kind of creative. So Double Trouble's cool and all, but Triple Threat's much better. TNA has their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view tonight. Actually, at the time I'm recording this, it's going to be starting in just a few hours. So if you are checking out, if you are one of the 7 or 8,000 people out there who are going to watch the TNA pay-per-view tonight, by all means, send in your feedback, post on Facebook what you think about it after the show. Sting defends the championship in the main event against Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle, who once said that he has to prove to himself that he can beat Sting because he's never beaten Sting, which, of course, was bullshit. So then he had to amend that and say, well, I don't think I've ever beaten Sting without outside interference or something like that. So Angle is on a mission. He's fighting for the championship tonight. And hopefully he won't do anything crazy like some moonsault off the top of the impact zone or something like that. I worry about this guy every time he has a pay-per-view match because he's crazy. So, until next week, episode 172, this is the Solid Monster signing off, thanking you all, as always, for listening. Be well, stay safe, and we'll be right back here next week. Have a good one, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on scoops.com.